Welcome to the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. I'm your host, Chase Maxwell. Twenty-one years ago, the Friends began a storytelling series for adults. What could be better than sitting by the fire, sipping a hot cup of coffee or cider, while listening to some of the best writers Minnesota has to offer? Over the years, the Fireside series has featured a great range of authors, from Kate DiCamillo to Jack Weatherford, Carol Bly to Jack Elhai, making the winter just that much more bearable. The 2015 lineup is no exception. Well, there actually is one exception, and you're listening to it. For over 20 years, the Fireside series has drawn enthusiastic crowds to the beautiful, but small, Hamlin Midway Library, and this is one way we're celebrating that legacy, by broadcasting the entire season and reaching a larger audience. The final episode of the podcast features Linda Lagarde Grover sharing her powerful debut novel of love, hardship, and family bonds, The Road Back to Sweetgrass. The book follows a trio of American Indian women from the 1970s to the present, observing their lives intersect on the fictional Moje Point Reservation. Grover connects the sense of place with the experience of Native women who came of age during the days of the federal termination policy and the struggle for tribal self-determination. She is an associate professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth and a member of the Boys Fort Band of Ojibwe. Grover is also the author of the short story collection, The Dance Boots, winner of the Flannery O'Connor Award and the Jeanette Heidinger Kafka Prize. So sit back, hopefully with a hot cup of cider in hand, and get ready to be transported.
Many thanks for coming here, and many thanks for the program and for having me here, for inviting me. It's a big honor to come here. Okay, so here I am. I live in Duluth. I was born in Duluth. Some of my family is here. I have a very large extended family, the Lagardes and all of our friends and honorary Lagardes, and we are we're a tight group. But we accept you all as our friends too. I'm enrolled at the Boys Fort Band of Ojibwe. The reservation is Net Lake, and that is north of here quite a ways. And so if you go up as far as Tower, Minnesota, it's right across the lake from Tower, Minnesota. That is the north of that is the area where my grandma's family is originally from. That's one little part of the reservation. The larger part in area is like 50 miles west. So if you go up 53 to Orr, Minnesota, and then you take a left at the dam, and then you go 18 miles in, you will get to Net Lake, the Net Lake Village, which is on the shores of Net Lake itself. And that is the larger part of the reservation in area. Tower, Minnesota, Vermilion area, where my family is enrolled at, is an original part of the reservation from a long time ago when reservation lands were being divided up into individual allotments. All of our allotments happened over at the Net Lake Village area. The Boys Fort people, our ancestors, were very intrepid folks. They actually took the federal government to court and got the Vermilion end of the reservation restored. That has never been divided up into individual land allotments and is owned in commonality by the band. So, do you know what an allotment is? When reservations were divided up into land plots and assigned to members of the band, people who had signed treaties or were descendants of people who signed treaties, that was all done over at Net Lake. And so, whether you're enrolled at Vermilion Boys Fort or else at Net Lake. Either way, if your family has been fortunate enough to hang on to their allotment lands, it would be on the Net Lake Reservation. And we have been fortunate in that way. Not all that usual. I teach at UMD. This is my 10th year in the Department of Indian Studies, but I've been there for quite a long time. I came there in 1985 and and was very pleased to be able to complete school while I was there. My final degree, my doctoral degree, came from the University of Minnesota, and I did it by kind of like a remote arrangement up in Duluth for most of our coursework. So I've been a really lucky person in a lot of ways, being in the right place at the right time, and I'm thankful for that. So with that, I began to write fiction after I had finished my dissertation. And I finished that in 1999. And my dissertation was, the research for it was, I decided to ask to do an interview project. And I thought that I would like to interview American Indian people in northern Minnesota about what they thought about the Indian boarding school experience. So I interviewed, I think, 16 people. And out of those interviews, I was asking just four general questions, open-ended questions about, you know, what do you know? Did you go? Do you have relatives who go? What do you hear about them? Do you think that there might have been effects on individuals, families, communities, tribes, by the boarding school education experience that might continue through today? What do you think? And so I typed all that stuff up, and it was very, very difficult. The recording and interviewing wasn't as hard as the typing up. It was revisiting and going back again. And that was really, really hard, because it was, when you're all alone, you really don't have to maintain. And so after about 6 months, I was done doing that, and I had felt really, really bad for, you know, and then I thought, well, okay, now it's time to get to work here, you know, so what about how you feel? So that's what I did. I began to write poetry, and so in my dissertation, I put some of the poetry I was writing, I put some of the comments, direct comments from the people I'd interviewed, and then what you call your findings, you know, like it's up to me to find this stuff out. So I really can't claim the credit for the dissertation. I, like with everything that I've written, I guess I've been the conduit for information to pass. And so that's what this fiction's all about. I've written some poetry. I've published a little poetry. The Road or the Dance Boots, which was published a few years ago, was my first book. And that is a collection of short stories that it's fiction, it's for general reading, but what I'm trying to do with my stuff is, in the dance booths, was to, through fiction, tell a story about the federal and church boarding school experiences and federal Indian education policy and assimilation policy for a period of time over about 100 years. So I took a series of 8 stories that told that story over a century. Road Back to Sweetgrass was just published last fall. That is like part 2 of what I'm doing. And so I have a fictional reservation called Moje Point. It's up in northern Minnesota. It's somewhat like Vermilion, somewhat like Net Lake, something like Grand Portage, and something like Fond du Lac, but it's fictional. Somebody asked me, where precisely would you put that reservation? And so I thought about it, and I thought, actually, it is in a place. And so I told this person, it is north of Nashwauk. So, and it's lovely up there. It's, you know, it is kind of remote. And so it is fictional. Moje Point is a fictional name. There are nonfiction things that are brought into here, though, and that is the policies themselves, which I refer to every once in a while, and also historical events that happen during the times when the books take place. The Road Back to Sweetgrass takes place, most of it, from around 1970 through now. And The Road Back to Sweetgrass, then, through fiction, addresses federal termination policies from the early 1950s through the late 80s. So the book does have things that, actually, it starts in 2014 with something very, very brief, but then it wraps back into experiences of young women who were born in probably early 1950s and when they came of age, when they were young women in the 70s and through today. So there are 3 or 4 of them. Actually, there are 2 of them who I feel the story is really about, and they experience life through different policies of the time. The federal relocation program, when Indians were given money and relocated someplace far away from home, hoping that they would never come back and would assimilate into larger American society. It also addresses the federal adoption program, and it addresses the sterilizations conducted by the Indian Health Service in the 1970s and 80s. So it's got some very heavy-duty stuff in here, and one of the reviews of this book talked about how the people in this book have been, I guess I'll paraphrase it, have been victimized, but do not consider themselves to be victims. And that's the big difference there. Because if you give in to something like that, then it's over, in my opinion. You cannot do that. And another review said, well, the characters in The Road Back to Sweetgrass do not all thrive, and some of them don't even survive. And yet there is a survival of the community and of a people as a whole. And so the individual, though, you know, our individual stories, of course, are really important to us because we're living here inside our heads, are not really as important in the bigger scheme of things as the story of the group. And I think that is a really Ojibwe Anishinaabe way of looking at things. We belong to a group. I think we're really lucky. We have that sense of place in time and space and where you're supposed to be and what is meant to be, and that whether you know what it is or not, you do have a destiny. You do have something that you were created for. We are, you know, you hear cliched stuff all the time. Oh, those American Indians, they're such spiritual people. I so admire that. But that actually is true. And so our tribal teachings are actually all spiritual, religious-based teachings. They work very well with other, I guess what you call organized religious beliefs. Our spiritual leader up at Net Lake was kind of explaining it to me one day that he didn't use the word umbrella, but that was the concept that he was talking about. It's an umbrella of beliefs. And with the way he was talking with me, he said, and some people do it the Christian way. But he thought, you know, they're all good. So there's an umbrella of beliefs. It sounds like such a comforting way to live, and it is. But these beliefs and this way of this worldview, this epistemology, butts up against a larger America that is it's more populated, it's stronger in many ways. And I mean, let's face it, we are in some ways almost like an occupied nation here. So we have the Indian nations here, but there are larger nations that came in, and through a series of all kinds of historical events, including the treaty making period, the lands upon which the native people lived became smaller and smaller. So Moje Point Reservation is one of these areas, fictional though it is. It is an area that is left off a very large tract of land that was ceded to another government entity, you know, the United States, and then returned then a specified amount of land, a specified area was going to be ceded back to the band, this fictional band. One question in The Road Back to Sweetgrass is who has the right to be on the land? There's a family that's lived here for a really long time who during the allotment period had to leave. Another family who that particular area, the Sweetgrass region, was allotted to, had to move from somewhere else to be there. Who has the legal right to the land? Who has the moral right to the land? Or does anybody have actually what we would call a right to that land, to be there? And what does it mean? What is the responsibility that goes with that right, whether it's legal or moral, to be on that land? That sounds pretty heavy duty when we're talking about a couple of young women who are in their late teens in 1970 and who don't know what they're going to do, what tomorrow is going to hold. They don't know what their lives are going to hold. They wonder if they will have good, successful lives. They wonder what's in the future. They're looking for something. Added to that is the angst of late adolescence, but also the position of responsibility that these young ladies are in as members of Indian tribes, as descendants of the people who made tremendous sacrifices so that we could be here today. What is their responsibility? Will they be up to it? What about all the other things that you have to do when you're young, like falling in love, you know, falling in love with somebody who might not love you back, which is sort of one of the things that happens here. You're just gonna just lay down and die. You feel so bad about this, right? And you know, we've all known that, you know, been in a situation like that. So In the middle of all this, their identity as Native women in northern Minnesota, their identity as Native women who carry on traditions, carry on the populating of the world, what are their responsibilities going to be? What do you do when you're 19 years old and you think, well, gosh, I don't really know how to do this. What'll I do? And besides, I'm in love. So the young women, there's a couple of them in Duluth. They go to a university in Duluth. That sounds kind of like UMD, but I don't think I have named it UMD. This is fiction after all. There's a young man from Mogé who comes to UMD to go to college too. Their experiences are sometimes a little bit strange. There's another young lady who lives up at Mogé herself who becomes recruited for the federal relocation program and leaves Mogé to move to an area where she's going to be taught a trade that will serve her all her life. She's going to be a telephone operator in Chicago. I was a telephone operator myself when I was 18. That was my first job and my first trade and my training, and that's what they told me. You will have a skill, you will, all your life, you will be able to find a good job. So 10 years later, I was living up on the range, and I was one of the people who were being laid off one by one by one by one by one as the switchboards disappeared. But it was pretty funny because when you're 18, you're kind of awestruck by this. Wow, I'm going to have a skill that will serve me all my life. But you do learn other things in the skills of your specific job, right? And it was the best job I ever had. There is nothing more fun than working a switchboard. I love being a professor in the Indian Studies Department, but I have to say, it's only a close second to hooking up telephone calls. So. This starts out with a little bit of an introduction to the area, and I hope that it kind of grounds things in the lands of Mogé Point. And so I'm going to read probably this little tiny page and then maybe something a little bit further on. But this is like an introduction to Mogé Point, and it's kind of like the way I think of it is we are the indigenous people here. We are the original people here, and the way Ojibwe are taught, and I hope it'll always be this way, is that when you have a guest in your house, you do your best to make them feel welcome, that they're, that you're honored that they're there. You find them a nice place to sit. You give them something to eat. You share what you have with them, and you make them comfortable. And so part of being a good Ojibwe is being a good host. And I take that a lot further than just having somebody come to your house. I think of it as the way we are in the land. And so I believe that people who came here are our guests and are deserving of courtesy and honor. And so with that, I will start out with this little bit here, which is called the Odissima bag, and it'll explain what it is. The opening day of the Mogé Point Ojibwe Reservation's wild rice harvest. Cumulus clouds drift slowly over the boat landing on Lost Lake, bringing with them the scent of sweetgrass. Among the ricers who pause to inhale the blessing are a teenage boy and his father, who park at the side of the road in a gray primered Ford truck faded to the near no color of glass. A young married couple who argue as they carry her parents' canoe toward the water, and an elderly woman who has just placed a pot of coffee to boil on an old car grill over a campfire. On this western end of Mogé, it happens that way occasionally when the wind comes from the northeast. The scent of sweetgrass edging and swirling from the LaForce family allotment land, its source somewhere near the maple sugar bush, making its invisible way past the cabin and down the driveway to the road, where it dissipates and fades when it reaches the boat landing. The Mogé Point ricers, who know that no sweet grass grows on the LaForce land, even in the swamp on the far side of the allotment, occasionally stop in their work to wonder about this. But the scent reminds us that we have been blessed by the Creator in all ways, understood or otherwise, here during our time on Mother Earth, and so we accept the mystery for what it is. And yet, in the old muskrat family sugarbush, there near the middle of the land that more than a century ago became the LaForce family land allotment, is where spirits tread so lightly that their feet, transparent as the air, make no more mark on the ground than air itself. With every step, the scent, invisibly compressed and released, renews and rises into the LaForce allotment atmosphere. And below the earth that is covered by leaves in fall, snow in winter, mud in spring, and sparse northern moss in summer, a small deerskin bag sewn with red thread and blue beads holds an infant's umbilical cord, an odissima, wrapped in dried sweetgrass. So it smells nice there, but nobody knows why. Sweetgrass is one of the four sacred, I can never think of a good word, would we call them, medicines of the Ojibwe and of other tribes too. So they are sweetgrass, sage, tobacco, and cedar. And so these are to have an infant's umbilical cord, little stem, wrapped in sweetgrass and maybe a little bit of cattail fluff and put into a pretty bag. Why in the world is that thing underground where nobody knows where it is? Do humans walk on it? Sometimes maybe, but in sweetgrass there are spirits treading on it and their little feet. That's what makes the scent rise to us here. The two young women, girls, who at the time the book starts are don't really know each other at the start of the book. And one is named Margie Robineau. She's one of the LaForce extended family that has legal title to the allotment up at Sweetgrass. The other is somebody who is distantly related, and her name is Dale Ann Dione, and she lives on her own family's allotment some distance from there. They don't meet each other. One lives in Duluth, the city. The other lives on the reservation. And their lives intersect along with the lives of a couple of other people they know, especially Margie's friend Teresa and the boy that Margie falls madly in love with, Michael Washington, who lives up on the Sweetgrass allotment, who is devastatingly handsome. What will happen? Okay. So I'm going to read this little chapter. It's the first chapter. It is called The Power of Fry Bread. And I put a year on here, 2014. So this is pretty recent. So this is about Margie. As she approached elderhood, Margie Robineau had come to be regarded as unarguably the hands-down best fry bread maker on the entire Moje Point Indian Reservation. Although she had unofficially held that title since she was 22, Indian country protocol and etiquette called for no recognition beyond that Margie, she makes pretty good fry bread. Until after Annie Buck, venerable elder and longtime fry bread queen, had died. Only then, and after a decent and respectful interval, did Margie become the person to ask about the fine points of fry bread making. Baking soda, powder, or yeast, commodity flour or gold metal, lard or Crisco, shortening or oil, spoon or hands, granulated sugar or powdered, rolled or sprinkled, cinnamon, honey, jelly, butter, no inquiries about margarine. Maple syrup, loaded Indian tacos, or fry bread, plain and simple. Margie's fry bread was so light it all but rose from the plate, so tender as to be all but unfelt in the mouth, so tasty that the very thought that the moment couldn't last forever brought to the eater an undertone of sorrow that added an intangible brine, like a grain of salt from dried tears yet to be wept. The golden rings that bloomed as they deep fried in hot lard grew from a dough mixture that she varied from day to day. Sometimes she used wheat flour, sometimes white. Sometimes she added blueberries. On occasion, if she was in a hurry, she didn't even let the dough rest before she fried it, sending it into the near-smoking grease deprived of its gestation in the dark and quiet of the dishcloth-covered mixing bowl. Variations didn't seem to matter. The resulting quality was always the same. She never minded if someone wanted to observe her while she cooked. After all, wasn't that the way of old-time Ojibwe tradition? To share, to teach by example, to learn by watching? Many watched, committing to memory her actions. They noted that she used sometimes her hands, sometimes a metal measuring spoon for the flour, sometimes her hands, sometimes a tablespoon from the silverware drawer for the leavening, sometimes her hands, sometimes a wooden spoon to stir. Those combinations, along with the precisely inexact points at which she added warm water, were tried by women all over Moje Point. Why, they asked themselves and each other, could no one else duplicate the fry bread that Margie made in her tiny, dark, and crowded kitchen at home in the Sweetgrass cabin and brought to potlucks and powwows? What was her secret? What wasn't she telling? Three of the Dione sisters, Yvonne, Annette, and Cecile, drove their ancient mother from the other side of the reservation, almost to the border between Moje and town, one morning to pay a call on Margie. As they passed the reservation business committee meeting, Dale Ann, the Moje Point tribal education director and oldest of the Dione girls, glanced out of her office window and recognized Annette's car careening off the road to take the shortcut through the RBC driveway and onto the road that led to Sweetgrass. "Name is Sayag Andi Gidisha." "Sisters, where are you going?" she said aloud, ducking behind the blinds. Knowing that the road to Sweetgrass crossed the southernmost corner of the forest allotment, she called to alert Margie, who then called her lady friend Teresa to come to the little house for a woman party. Margie and Teresa were ready for company and waiting at the door when the car drove up the driveway through the sumac stand that obscured the house from the road. The sisters opened the car doors, which let in the mysterious and elusive scent of Sweetgrass that floated on the lightest of breezes to tease their noses. The Dione women inhaled deeply, turning their heads to follow the scent, to capture it. The intake calmed their demeanors, which became nearly consistently pleasant for the time that they were on the LaForce family allotment grounds. Teresa waved hugely. "Middle geisha good, Margie, it's the Dione ladies." "Aneen, Margie, Aneen, Teresa, it is good to see you," they said, sweet as boiled down sap. "We were just taking Mother here for a little ride, and when we saw you were home, we decided to stop by." "Bind again, gae na matabin." While Margie welcomed the women and found them comfortable places to sit, near the door for Yvonne, who suffered from hot flashes, next to the stove for Annette, who was always cold, Teresa switched on the Mr. Coffee and set the kettle on the stove for tea. Courteously, she asked about Mrs. Dione's bad knee and if she liked her new washing machine and how all of the grandchildren and great-grandchildren were while she poured coffee and hot water and offered sugar and milk. Cecile reminded Margie and Teresa that she couldn't tolerate dairy at all. "Would you ladies eat a little fry bread if I mix some up?" asked Margie. The ladies thought they could if the pieces weren't too big. "And how is Dale Ann?" she asked, lifting the mixing bowl from the bottom cupboard. "Yes, what is Big Sister up to?" Teresa inquired. "Busy all the time these days, I bet, She settled into her chair to observe the Diones while they watched Margie prepare a batch of fry bread. Old Lady Dione took half milk and half coffee with four sugars, which she stirred for a full minute. "Nice and hot," she complimented, wrapping her cup in a napkin to lift it. It's good. You girls make good coffee. My big girl? Oh, she's busy. Working, taking care of things all over the reservation. But you know, no matter how busy she gets, she always makes the time for me, whatever I need. She sighed happily and then, Annette, get me something for my feet, she said impatiently. There's no more chairs, Annette said critically, then remembered where she was and what she wanted and smiled stiffly at the room. I don't think. Her dimples all but creaked. Here you go, Auntie Grace. Teresa put her own sweater under the old woman's legs, first patting it with her sweater. Is that better? You're a good girl, Teresa. Now, what was I saying? Oh, I remember, yes. Big sister, busy all over the reservation. She always did make us proud, always doing something nice for somebody. Had that good job, and then she went back to school. And she was so smart, she made us all proud there. And then she was way too busy to get married, muttered Yvonne. Even if somebody would have asked her, whispered Cecile. Gajigan, ski wee mina kwe, anadudu shabu, asked Annette. Cat, you want some milk to drink? And all those little kids, my, she treated them just like they were her own. But now that she's in charge of all that education, she's got so much going on that everything she has to do, she just doesn't have much time left to be at Head Start anymore. Those little kids, they all love her. They must really miss her. She stops by sometimes, though. While their mother talked, the Dione girls sugared their tea and coffee, then let it go cold, ignoring it to watch closely as Margie worked, intending once and for all to discover what was the secret ingredient in the dough that she mixed and handled. They saw nothing unusual, just the mixing of the ingredients that could be found in their own kitchen cupboards. What sleight of hand was Margie using? What motions did she make that were quicker than the eye? The fry bread was, as always, delectable, perhaps even more than usual, this time perhaps even too good to dunk. Yvonne had a lot of pride, which could be either a source of strength or the source of occasional but regular downfalls. She knew that but was too proud to change. But she humbled herself to ask if Margie could write down the recipe. Here is what Margie wrote. Fry bread. Almost 2 cups of flour. Almost 1 tablespoon of BP. Pretty small size pinch of salt. A little sugar, maybe 1 teaspoon. This is up to you if you want it. Mix this in a good-sized bowl and then make a little river in a circle. Add warm water to make the dough nice and soft. Cover and give it a little rest after you mix. Fry it like donuts. Good with butter or honey or jelly or syrup or plain. This makes a good lugolette too. For lug, bake it in a pan. Cut it up, but grease the pan first. Away from the spell of sweetgrass, the demeanor of the Dione girls returned to its norm. In the front seat, Yvonne and Annette argued over the radio, first one and then the other punching the selection button every few minutes to switch from country western to oldies, oldies to country western. In the back seat, Cecile fidgeted indignantly until her mother told her to sit still. She was making her car sick. Anyhow, that's the way we always make it, just the same way Margie did, Annette complained. Well, next time we'll use yeast instead of baking powder, or else soda. Maybe that's what she's been doing. Maybe she's been using all three. Yvonne wondered if it was Margie's stove. Notice she never makes it any place else but at her own house. And that Teresa, sitting there like that, all smiling and just quiet. You know she knows all about it. Yvonne expressed this indignantly. And after her stealing Margie's man, too, why would Margie ever even talk to her? The vision that crossed Annette's mind and eyes of Michael Washington as a young man diverted her attention. The car swerved slightly. In the back seat, Cecile squealed. Sister, watch your driving there. You want to go right off the road, she snapped. The car righted. She tossed her head. Well, Margie sure showed her. Who gets to be the big boss lady at Chihuahua? Not Teresa. Michael probably helped her to get that job. He owes her plenty. Not to mention his father. And all I can say is it's a good thing her fry bread is as soft as it is. Otherwise, that old Joe Washington would probably have starved to death on the rest of her cooking. Cecile grumbled. She snuck something in there when we weren't looking. She's just a stingy gut, that Margie, keeping her stupid secret to herself. Well, she can just have it. Old Lady Dione told her girls that Margie had made the fry bread as she always had, with the same results, and that perhaps it was jealousy that was causing their bread to toughen and shrink. Jealousy? Jealousy! Without speaking aloud, the sisters agreed to silence in the car for the remainder of the ride back to the Dione allotment, and Annette turned up Garth Brooks. Here is part of Margie's secret, unrequited love. The LaForce family land allotment in Sweetgrass, and not too much sugar when you add that little bit. But without Joe Washington's grandmother, the three would have remained unconnected, as would have the ingredients that went into Margie's mixing bowl and came out fry bread, as would have the ingredients that went into her existence and came out Margie's life.
We've reached one of the best parts of the Fireside series, the Q&A with the author and our dedicated audience. It's a chance to go beyond the book, connecting readers and writers on a deeper level. To make it easier for you, the listener, I've summarized the questions and we'll read them. First up, an audience member asked about Margie's top secret delectable fry bread recipe and the ingredients that constitute Grover's writing style. Is there any metaphorical parallel between the two?
The secret ingredient. But it is a secret. Next question. I would ask for a show of hands here, but I bet I could guess here. Who here has ever known Michael Washington? I know. Yeah, so.
It seems that some things must remain secret, including Margie's fry bread recipe. The next question is about a Moshe Reservation institution that Grover references in the novel, the Reservation Business Committee. The audience member points out that these groups are often called Reservation Business Councils, not committees. Did Grover purposefully tweak this term to fit in her fictional setting?
I went with Reservation Business Committee because that's what it was called in like the 70s and 80s. And even though this is in 2014, What I'm thinking is that these ladies are people of my generation, and they might still call it the Reservation Business Committee or the RBC. And some people, at some places, they call it the Reservation Tribal Council. I've heard people call it RTC in some places, not here. But that's why I did, because it's, and I know there's a student of mine who is from Rosebud in South Dakota has read this book too, and he said, oh yeah, he said those buildings are called lots of different places. And what he wanted to say is when you live in a really remote area, some of these reservations are, that building becomes like the kind of like the social hub, that this is where people, when they talk about going someplace, this is the marker. So that's why I left it there, and I've always been so fond of that. And so in the book, even though I'll call it that, and the RBC, I spell it out like ARBEESEE, because like the RBC, because that's what people always used to say, going to the RBC, you know. Who knows what's there? The pop machine, you know. Yeah.
Next up, an audience member asked about the importance of food and recipes in Grover's writing. Does she discuss other types of food in the novel, and why is fry bread such an important element?
It is. And you know, as I get to the end of this book here, right now this is Margie approaching elderhood and she's making fry bread at her house. The people coming to her house are older people. These days, fry bread gets a lot of pokes in the eye, because it is not really an indigenous food. It was dough and flour were introduced here by European people who came here. And so in this part of the world, in northern Minnesota especially, the diet did not include flour. And so doughy stuff has kind of wreaked havoc with people's physical well-being over the years. And so if people, you know, people will think, oh, fry bread, that's Indian food. Well, it has become that because it's an adapted kind of food, and it's really good. But near the end of the book here, as there is another generation, you got somebody watching Margie making fry bread and going, oh, I can't eat that stuff, you know, because it's bad, bad, bad. But, and I know it's not good for you, and I, you know, I, my dad always, you know, I don't know if he really thought this or not, but he always used to tell me when I made fry bread that I made really good fry bread. But I noticed that he always reached for what looked like a little piece, and then he'd eat it and he'd see how good it was, and then he would say, this stuff will kill you. And I mean, this is, you know, 25 years ago, and you know, that is true. And so in the indigenous diet, yeah, they do ricing in this book, and they've got the maple sugaring, so they do the maple sugar harvest, and so there's talk about other foods. I think people seem to do a lot of harvesting and preparation of foods in this book, and that's the way that it is up north, and hunting and eating wild meat, you know, deer and rabbit. And that those really would be indigenous foods. But fry bread became to be sort of, I don't know, an emblematic food of Indians. So now, I don't know, do we have to feel really, really bad when we eat it? I'm not sure. I'm never sure what to do in the 21st century here, but I just close my eyes and eat it.
Following that question, an audience member asked if Margie's character is derived from someone in Grover's life. Does Grover know someone like Margie who's a fry bread genius?
No, but there are people who have just a hand with it. And so there is actually a girl in this book who is not Margie, who is very much like someone I know, who I've known for many years, who is really good at making fry bread. And we don't know why she is. So yeah, we've copied her, and she's, you know, she's always really nice about things, but hers is always way better than everybody else's. So what's her secret? I don't know if it's unrequited love. I could ask her, I suppose, and see if she sees herself in this book. So Margie and that young woman, Teresa, they were about the first fictional people that I wrote about. So this is quite a while before The Dance Boots came out. The Dance Boots has as its beginning anchoring person, I guess, one of the LaForce family named Artense, who is also about my age. But before she ever happened, I remember I was sitting watching TV, and I was sitting on the recliner at home, and I had my laptop there, and I was actually looking at eBay. And then I just started to write about Margie. I don't know why. And so she isn't any particular person. She has her own, I think that she has a pretty distinct personality. She's kind of a lost person for much of the time in the book. So when I start the book here, she's pretty much, I mean, she's pretty established her place in the world. She's kind of reconciled things. She's approaching elderhood, and she makes pretty good fry bread. And she's living on sweetgrass. But how did she get to that? Well, you know, being sort of a lost young woman, and somehow or other finding or being found is part of the story. And with Dale Ann too, the other, who I think is the other, one of the other main people in this book, Dale Ann lived up at Moje up north, and she was a good student and really did pretty well in school, and really wanted to, really enjoyed this and wanted to do some stuff. And these days we might see a student like that being approached by a college recruiter and maybe even offered a scholarship. But instead Dale Ann is approached by someone from the Federal Relocation Program and told that she has such tremendous promise that they'd like to send her to Chicago, and that not only is she a good student, but she can be the shining star of her entire reservation. That's a pretty tough thing to have somebody telling you when you're 18. I mean, do you just kind of hide your eyes and duck, or do you go with it? Life turns on a dime. And so her experiences in Chicago, sometimes they were traumatic. But at any moment, any choice that we make, it's kind of like in a pinball or something. That I love that saying, life turns on a dime. You know, you decide, you're going to decide to have toast this morning instead of cereal. You know, what will that mean? And so with Dale Ann, in a split second, where will this take her in her life? And is there any way back for people who really fall very, very hard? And on whose terms are they falling really hard? Are they hardest on themselves? And that sense of belonging to something and being part of a group of people and part of something that is truly significant, that I think is one of the great gifts of being a Native person, that also, though, can be a tremendous burden. So what happens when somebody who is going to be the hope of everybody falls from grace? What happens to them next? Can you come back? And so there, I think that in Sweetgrass, as there is in Dance Boots, there is the possibility of redemption for people. Not everybody's going to make it, but that possibility is there. And the idea of optimism and luck, it doesn't sound like optimism and luck here, but I do think that my dad always used to tell us we were lucky, and so we thought of ourselves as lucky. And so in Sweetgrass and Under the Brooks too, lucky, fortunate, but also luck by the luck of the draw. Boy, that was lucky. Boy, that's really lucky. So in Sweetgrass, remember I was talking about allotments, there is a family then, longtime family that loses that land. And then through the twists and turns, somebody wrote this, so I didn't make this up myself, the twists and turns of life and fortune and policies and marriages and relationships and somebody passing somebody at the gas station, somehow the land comes back to them. How did this happen? Was this part of the big scheme of things? Was this meant to be? Luck of the draw, life turning on a dime. I guess I have to say I don't know.
The next question is about the character of Professor Rogers' head in The Road Back to Sweetgrass, a white woman who embraces Native culture and, some would even say, appropriates it. Does Grover have any personal experiences that inspired this character? And how does she feel generally about cultural appropriation?
Regularly. How do Indian people feel about butter versus margarine? You just go, I don't know. No, seriously. No, I do.
Very much falls from the book of authors, and there's a phrase, something about that white girl in South St. Paul who's more Indian than me.
Oh, that's Marcy Rendon's poem.
Yeah.
What's an Indian girl to do when the white girls act more Indian than the Indian girls do? Yeah, I love that poem. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they call it, these days I think there's a word, they use the word cultural appropriation for that. So, I mean, where do you draw the line between I really think that's nice and I'd really like to, yeah. Where do you draw the line? I don't know, I guess each person needs to in their heart, but understanding that where your heart isn't necessarily where the person you're passing on the street's heart is, who might say, what the heck are you doing with that feather? And not understanding the meanings of some of these things, because I know I'm joking and stuff, but there's meaning to stuff that is beyond just, and I don't want to say just, beyond the cultural, like United Nations type things. It's more than that, because Native beliefs are so absolutely not separated from the spiritual and religious beliefs. It can be easy, I think, to inadvertently offend somebody with things like this. And so I know that poor professor, I know I made her and I set her up and, I did that, But once in a while you run into somebody like that too. And, it used to surprise me, in America, I think our standard of living is better than it used to be in so many ways. But I can remember being somewhere, like even at a powwow, where I'd see an American Indian person walking around who's, some guy walking around in, work pants and shirt, and, he's just walking around visiting around, and then he's an Indian guy, and then you might see a non-Indian guy who has, $800 worth of Navajo silver and turquoise that he's, and you just think, well, yeah, it's really pretty and you really like it, and do you, and I'm not going to go up to somebody and start questioning them. I was told, and this was very interesting to me, I mean, we're a whole different way of life and culture up here from the Navajo people, but I never knew this, that turquoise is a gift that honors Navajo men, and that when Navajo women wear turquoise, they are doing that to acknowledge and to honor men. And I never knew that. Somebody told me that once. All these things that we don't know, when we might pick something up and just think that's pretty, but what else is there? What is the further meaning with this? And so you don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, because I heard a Native author make fun of an audience once of some lady who was wearing, a non-Indian lady who was wearing a beaded barrette. And I think she wore that because she wanted to wear something appropriate and nice for the occasion. And it was a pretty nice barrette. And I think it probably cost her a few bucks. But I just thought, you know, really, is it necessary to call her out and make fun of her in front of everybody here, you know? I mean, you feel that way, but I mean, didn't your aunties teach you, you know, good Native guy manners or what? That's what we all said after. So.
The next question and the final question returns to the topic of food in Grover's novel. Has Grover ever gone ricing, and can she address the importance of rice in Ojibwe culture?
I have gone ricing. It's hot, and there are a lot of bugs. And so when Crystal is tying her hair up in a dish towel in a turban, that's why. Yeah. So it's amazingly labor-intensive work. So, you know, if you're buying rice somewhere and it says it's like hand-processed, hand-finished rice and it's expensive, the reason for that is because it is so labor-intensive. It isn't really worth your time if you're trying to make money. Years ago, this was the source of income for lots of people, what they got from ricing during the year. But, you know, for people whose entire annual income in dollars might have been $500 for a year, living in a different type of economy without as much cash money, that was going to like buy fuel, school clothes, a chainsaw for work out in the woods to make some more money. And so these days, when people rice, you know, there are people who make a little bit of money, and there's rice brokers and people who will finish it for you and stuff, but it's still not a big moneymaker for an individual. But that isn't the reason people do it. It's a sacred food. I mean, there's a story about the great migration of the Ojibwe and you know, the great spirit, God, providing with wild rice, feeding people a miraculous food that grows out of water. And so the harvest itself has a sacredness to it. And so eating wild rice has a sacredness to it. So yeah, people rice. So I like the title of that section, I think, The Wild Ricers. It's just, so I think we're, I would be really happy to talk with you individually if anybody would like to, and you know, well, many, many thanks.
You've been listening to the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. We've reached the end of our inaugural season. I can tentatively say that Season 2 of the podcast will premiere in January 2016. Until then, we hope you consider supporting the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library and its mission, Stronger Libraries for Stronger Communities. Learn more at thefriends.org. Follow us on Twitter at The Friends and on Facebook at facebook.com/friendsofsppl. Please consider subscribing to this podcast on iTunes.